So what happens next, sir? The old spymaster sighed. We leave it to them. There will be some changes made. They will make them in their own inimitable way. The man back there in the house will set them in train. His career will be advanced, that of others broken. And Philby? Asked Preston. What about Philby? Is he trying to come home? Sir Nigel shrugged impatiently. For years past, he said. And yes, he's in touch from time to time, covertly, with my people in our embassy over there. We breed pigeons. Pigeons? Very old-fashioned, I know, and simple, but still surprisingly efficient. That's how he communicates. But not about Plan Aurora. And even if he had, so far as I'm concerned, so far as you're concerned, he can rot in hell, said Sir Nigel softly. They drove for a while in silence. What about you, John? Will you stay with Five now? I don't think so, sir. I've had a good run. The DG retires on the 1st of September, but he'll take final leave next month. I don't fancy my chances under his successor. Can't take you into Six. You know that. We don't take late entrants. Thought of returning to Civvy Street? Not the best time for a man with no known skills to get a job nowadays, said Preston. I have some friends, mused the master. They're in asset protection. They might be able to use a good man. I could have a word. Asset protection. Oil wells, mines, deposits, racehorses, things people want kept safe from theft or destruction. Even themselves. It would pay well, enable you to take full care of that son of yours. It seems I'm not the only one who checks up on things, grinned Preston. The older man was staring out of the window, as if at something far away and long ago. Had a son myself once, he said quietly. Just the one. Fine lad. Killed in the Falklands. Know how you feel? With surprise, Preston glanced at the man in the mirror. It had never occurred to him that this urbane and wily spymaster had once played horse and rider with a small boy on a sitting-room carpet. I'm sorry. Perhaps I'll take you up on that. They arrived at the airport, checked in the rented car, and flew back to London, as anonymous as they had come. The man in the window of the safe house watched the Britisher's car drive away. His own would not be there for an hour. He turned back to the room and sat down at the desk to study again the folder he had been brought, and which he still held in his hands. He was pleased. It had been a good meeting, and the documents he had would secure his future. As a professional, Lieutenant General Yevgeny Karpov was sorry about Plan Aurora. It had been good, subtle, low profile, and effective, but also as a professional he knew that once an operation was well and truly burned, there was nothing for it but to cancel and repudiate the whole thing before it was too late. To delay would have been utterly disastrous. He recalled clearly the batch of documents that his bagman had brought from Jan Marais in London, the product of his agent, Hampstead. Six had been the usual stuff, top-rate intelligence material, such as only a man of the eminence of George Berenson could have acquired. The seventh had caused him to sit transfixed. It was a personal memorandum from Berenson to Marais, for on passing to Pretoria. In it, the Defence Ministry official had told Howe, as Deputy Director of Procurement with special responsibility for nuclear devices, he had been present at a very restricted briefing by the Director-General of MI5, Sir Bernard Hemmings. The counterintelligence chief had told the small group that his agency had uncovered the existence and most of the details of a Soviet conspiracy to import in kit form, assemble and detonate a small atomic device inside Britain. The sting was in the tail. MI5 was closing fast upon the Russian illegal in command of the operation in Britain, and was confident of catching him with all the necessary evidence upon him. Entirely because of its source, General Karpov had believed the report completely. There was an immediate temptation to let the British go ahead, but second thoughts showed this to be disastrous. If the British succeeded alone and unaided, there would be no obligation to suppress the horrendous scandal. To create that obligation, he needed to send a message, and to a man who would understand what had to be done, someone he could deal with across the Great Divide. Then there was the question of his personal self-advancement. It was after a long, lonely walk in the spring-green forests of Pyeredelkina that he had decided to take the most dangerous gamble of his life. He had decided to pay his discreet visit to the private office of Nubar Gevorkovich Vartanyan. He had chosen his man with care. The Politburo member from Armenia was believed to be the man who headed the covert faction inside the Politburo that privately thought it was time for a change at the top. Vartanyan had listened to him without saying a word, secure that he was far too highly placed for his office to be bugged. He just stared at the KGB general with his black lizard's eyes as he listened. When Karpov had finished, he had asked,
"You are certain your information is correct, Comrade General?"
"I have the full narrative from Professor Krylov on tape," said Karpov. "The machine was in my briefcase at the time."
"And the information from London?"
"Its source is impeccable. I have run the man personally for nearly 3 years."
The Armenian power broker stared at him for a long time, as if reflecting on many things, not least how this information could be used to advantage. "If what you say is true, there has been recklessness and adventurism at the highest level in our country. If such could be proved, but one would need the proof, there might have to be changes at the top."
"Good day to you." Karpov had understood. When the man on the pinnacle in Soviet Russia fell, all his placemen fell with him. If there were changes at the top, there would be a vacant slot as chairman of the KGB, a slot that Karpov felt would suit him admirably. But to cobble together his alliance of party forces, Vartanyan would need proof, more proof, solid, irrefutable, documentary proof, that the act of recklessness had almost brought disaster. No one had ever forgotten that Mikhail Suslov had toppled Khrushchev in 1964 on charges of adventurism over the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. Shortly after the meeting, Karpov had sent in Winkler, the most bumbling agent his files could unearth. His message had been read and understood. Now he held in his hands the proof his Armenian patron had needed. He looked through the documents again. The report of the mythical interrogation and the confession of Major Valery Petrovsky to the British would need some amendment, but he had people out at Yazyenovo who could accomplish that. The interrogation report forms were absolutely authentic, that was the main thing. Even Mr. Preston's reports on his progress, suitably amended to exclude any mention of Winkler, were photocopies of the originals. The General Secretary personally would not be able or willing to save the traitor Philby, nor, later, would he be able to save himself. Vartanyan would see to that, and he would not be ungrateful. Karpov's car came to take him to Zurich and the Moscow plane. He rose. It had been a good meeting, and, as always, it had been rewarding to negotiate with Chelsea. Epilogue. Sir Bernard Hemmings formally retired on the 1st of September 1987, although he had been on leave since mid-July.